and Baba Yaga, and what happened when young women came to visit them. The stories differed in key parts. The Ala wore a horse's head while delousing her human head. Baba Yaga, in her heyday, was almost a goddess. But the stories always ended the same way, with the demon devouring her nosy visitor in one bite. Chapter 6. The Saturday of the auction is hot but not humid. Adam's truck has air conditioning, but when he asks if they can drive with the windows open, she says yes. Polly always plays the good sport, the girl, woman, who doesn't mind if her hair gets tousled. Being a good sport sounds like such a good thing, but there's no good thing that can't become bad for you. Polly looks at the skies, remembers some tiny shred of poetry from grade school, something about blue skies arching. She never got that. How can a sky arch? It doesn't touch the ground.
What do you need?
He asks her.
Everything.
She doubles down on that one word, gives him a quick glance, but level, not through the lashes. She hates women who do that, peer through their lashes.
You got a budget?
Easy to get carried away at an auction. There's something about someone else trying to get what you want, even if you don't want it that bad, that can make you crazy.
Tell me about it.
She's been clocking Calf, clocking Adam. She's wearing a sundress that she found in the Purple Heart on Main Street. In a vintage shop back in Baltimore, this same dress might cost $50, $75. Here, it was $12. Her body is made for clothes like this, fitted through the bodice, then a big swirl of a skirt, patterned with bright fruits. She found a pair of earrings, purple glass grapes that dangle from her lobes, a little matchy-matchy, but it works. She wears flat sandals, and when she starts roaming the dusty rows of furniture and housewares at the auction, it feels as if something is nibbling at her ankles. What kind of bug can live in such dry dust? More than once, she feels his gaze on her shoulders. She knows she has a beautiful back, her bones clearly visible, but not in a way that makes her look underfed or scrawny. Her shoulder blades look like wings, or so she's been told by more than one man. Two, to be exact, both husbands. This one says nothing, though. Today he seems determined not to compliment her. Focus on what you need, she tells herself, not what you want. She shouldn't be buying anything, but she did the math. The motel, at $220 a week, was $880 a month. So, she's saving $580 by taking the apartment, which means she can get out west by September, wrap things up mid-October. But she can't live in a completely empty apartment for 2 months. She needs utensils, a kitchen table, a couple of chairs. She wants an iron bed, a full set of jadeite, a quilt in the log cabin pattern. Right off the bat, she finds a little deco table, white and black metal top, painted white base, no matching chairs, so it will go cheap, and it does, only $65. Now, to find two chairs. There are two white painted ones made of cane, but she passes on those. No man will want to sit on those chairs. Why is she thinking about men anyway? Then she has the brainstorm of buying only one chair, a lonely wooden chair from some old schoolhouse, which gets his attention.
Not planning to entertain?
Adam asks. I never entertain. She has the resolve to pass on the jadeite. She's not much for cooking and, as she just told Adam, she doesn't entertain. But she can't say no to the quilt. It's so much like one that was on her Frau Frau's spare bed when she was a child. Hot chocolate and strudel for breakfast, making a tent with Cousin Annie, playing war by flashlight. Even though Polly is not planning to spend a single winter's night in Belleville, she has to have it. Then an iron bed comes up. Oh, it's a beauty. White, with gold details. Polly has a tricky back, prone to going out. Sleeping on a mattress without a box spring isn't good for her.
Looks awfully small, Adam says.
You don't often find them larger than full, she says. People didn't used to think they needed so much room in bed.
I like a king myself, he says.
Then you'll probably never have an antique bed. She has set her limit at $150, which is $150 too much. She tries to put up her paddle, as if she couldn't care less, but she feels her heart thrumming in her chest as the price rises. Another woman is bidding, a little older than her, definitely richer. Polly sees the flash of jewels on the other woman's hands, at her throat. She hates her. She wants to kill her. They are at $175, $200, $225. She wants this bed so bad.
Do you have any cash on you?
She asks Adam.
Don't get carried away.
Did I ask your advice? Do you have any cash on you? You know I'm good for it.
You can't spend more on a bed than you do on your rent.
Don't tell me what I can do. The choice has slipped away during their argument, and the other woman has won the beautiful bed for $275. Polly's so angry she has to stalk away, fuming. She's not sure who she's angrier with, the woman who got her bed or the man who argued with her over what she could afford. Or herself for caring so much about a damn bed. But in her mind's eye, she already owned that bed, covered with the quilt, and maybe thrown over the foot a man's silk bathrobe that she bought at the Purple Heart. It's purple, covered with dragons. Too big for her, and too hot for the current weather. But it makes her feel like royalty when she pulls it over her naked body, walks around her empty rooms. She cools down, returns to the auction. When he raises his eyebrows in a question, "You okay?" She raises hers, as if she has no idea what he's asking. She doesn't bid again. But when they go to collect her purchases at the end of the auction, there's the bed, waiting with her table, chair, and quilt. What the?
I asked the lady if she wanted to make a quick profit.
How much do I owe you?
$225.
No way she let it go for 50 less than she paid. He answers her unvoiced skepticism.
She thought she could come back and get it later. But this auction is strictly cash and carry. Would have cost her at least $50 to haul it away, and that's assuming she could find someone with a truck who wanted to drive all the way to Oxford today. And it's strictly no refund, so getting $225 from me meant losing only $50. Pricey mistake for people like us, but she didn't bat an eye.
Polly doesn't believe a word of it, but it's not the first time someone has gone out of the way to pay her tribute. Men have always done things for her. People. And she never asks. That is, she never seems to ask. He won't even remember that she hit him up for a loan. He won't want to remember. He's her savior. Mr. Magnanimous. It's a special art, asking people to do things, yet making it seem as if you never asked at all. There are talents she would prefer to this one, because favors often carry a hefty penalty when it's time to return them. But it's the skill she was given, the hand she has to play. So he bought her a bed. It's funny. When she was mad at him, she was thinking that she just might get him to make a move tonight. Tonight or on the drive back home. All it would take is a hand on his thigh, about halfway up. But now that he's bought her a bed, she's going to have to deny him a little while longer. It would seem too much like commerce, tit for tat, quid pro quo, bed for bed. He bought her a bed. On the drive home, she keeps her face turned toward the cornfields and those arching blue skies, not wanting him to see how wide her grin is. Chapter 7. Greg lets Janny have chocolate cake for breakfast. Why not? In the end, what's the difference between cake and a muffin? Or even cereal?
Besides, he'll do anything to avoid whining. Pauline was always going on and on about schedules. Kids need schedules. They thrive when life is orderly. But Janny's doing fine. Other than the fact that her mother disappeared 4 weeks ago and hasn't been heard from except for a letter that arrived 4 days ago, postmarked Philadelphia. If he's sure of anything, he knows Pauline's not in Philadelphia. Someone probably mailed it for her. She had that way about her, of getting people, strangers even, to do her favors. She certainly got him to do her a lot of favors. Marry her, become a dad, buy a brick house near a park. This whole setup was all for her, and now she's left him holding the bag. The letter's not even addressed to him. It's to Janny. A greeting card with a bear on the front. The imprinted message, "I can't bear being away." Then, in her tight, up-and-down script, "I love you, I miss you," lies, lies, lies. Well, today's the day. It's been 4 weeks, and she's clearly not coming back. Maybe she's certifiably insane. Wouldn't that be just his luck? At any rate, he needs to find her and get her back to Baltimore to take care of Janny. He's made an appointment with a private detective, a woman. He wouldn't trust any man around Pauline. No, it's not the men he doesn't trust, it's Pauline. She's just too good at getting what she wants. Why did he ever fall for her? She's not that pretty. Her shape is good, but not crazy insane great. The sex was good, though. The private detective's office is up in Towson, and he's arranged to come in late at the office, although things are crazy busy. After spiking up last year, interest rates are back down, not 1993 levels, but under 8% for a 30-year fixed, and lower still for the adjustable-rate mortgages that are so popular now. Everyone's trying to sell and buy before school starts up. Summer's barely started, and people are already thinking about fall. He drops Janny at his mom's. He thought grandmothers were supposed to love their grandchildren, to the point where they could never get enough of them. But his mom's getting a little cheesed off about all the babysitting over the past month. He hasn't told her the exact truth about Pauline. He dropped a hint that she had to go somewhere to take care of a family member, but he didn't provide many details. He's not sure why he's lying to his mother. It's not like he and Pauline are going to get back together. He guesses he just doesn't want his mother to say, "I told you so." She hated Pauline from the start. Said she didn't seem like wife material. But Greg hadn't been looking for wife material. He tried to make the best of it when she got pregnant. But it was foolish to think that you could marry a party girl and she would figure out how to be a party girl by night, a mom and wife by day. Now he knows it doesn't work that way. The detective's office is in a beige building off Joppa Road, a place with a credit union on the first floor and a lot of professional places above. Dentists, podiatrists, urologists, but only one private detective. Not how he imagined it. Then he realizes he was imagining an old movie, Venetian blinds behind a glass panel with the agency's name stenciled in gold letters, "This Gun for Hire." Here, there is a plastic nameplate, "Security Associates." Inside, "Sue Sneed." Wait, did he pick her for the name? Without making the association, Sue Sneed, Sam Spade? Is small and nondescript, an asset in her work, if not her life. Probably a lesbian, he thinks, taking in her short hair, button-down shirt, khakis. "Office buildings are air-conditioned for men," she says. What? Her voice is gorgeous. Unexpected. It's like listening to beautiful music pour out of some kid's rinky-dink toy piano. "That's why I wear pants and long-sleeve shirts, even on a day with temperatures in the 90s. Because the business world, its thermostats are set to temperatures that are comfortable for people who wear suits. The women come in bare-legged, in sleeveless tops, then complain that they're freezing. Interesting, he says. It's not, but what does it cost him?
I think the first thing we need to do is a background check on your wife, which means I'll order a search of all legal databases through Chicago Title.
She's got no legal troubles.
How do you know? Her tone is kind, her eyes round and serious. She's not challenging him. And for the first time he thinks, how do I know?
You meet a woman in a bar. She's fun. You tell her your best stories. She laughs and tells hers. Only Pauline Smith never did, come to think of it, tell stories. She laughed and asked for more of his. In Baltimore, people always start with, where'd you go to school? They mean high school, not college. But she always said she wasn't from Baltimore, that she grew up in West Virginia. And the weird thing about West Virginia is that although you can drive there in 2 hours, it feels like it's a million miles away. There's a reason they have those bunkers at the Greenbrier Hotel, in case D.C. is ever nuked. Greg plays the license plate game on road trips, a hangover from childhood, and you seldom see a West Virginia tag east of Hagerstown. Less often than Vermont, even. About as often as Utah, he reckons.
Let's start with what you do know, Sue Sneed says, her pen at the ready.
Well, her name, her birth date, her social. And the social has to be right because we file a joint return.
Where does she work?
She doesn't.
Oh, he remembers. You're supposed to say it differently.
She didn't have a job outside the home, I mean. She was a full-time mom. A good one, too. She loves our little girl. Or, I thought she did.
They talk for almost an hour. And while part of him is clocking the cost, there's another part of him that enjoys the conversation. All those questions in that honeyed voice. Usually talking to a woman this long is a prelude to sex. Maybe this is what going to a therapist is like. She seems so interested in him. Kind and supportive. No detail is too small, she keeps telling him. He finds himself talking about what it was like at first. The sex with Pauline, how great it was, and then she got pregnant and everything changed. Like, she would be up for sex in odd places. Outdoors, the spare bedroom at a party. But she scoped it out first. Made sure it was unlikely they would be seen. Did that mean the wildness was a calculation? Or something she had learned to control? He doesn't mention the hitting, though. He admits to Sue Sneed that he was thinking about leaving. But the only thing he cares about now is finding Pauline, making sure she's not in trouble, helping his little girl, who's broken-hearted. Divorce is inevitable. But it can be civilized, he says. Gambling problem? Drugs? Alcohol? He shakes his head no to each question. Sure. She's bought a lottery ticket here or there, done a bump of cocaine on special occasions, enjoys a cocktail. But she's the opposite of an addict. The only person he's ever known who could smoke 3 or 5 times a year then let it go. It's impossible to imagine her enthralled to anything, anyone. She calls the shots while pretending not to. Even in motherhood, she has shown this steely control. She was never the type of mother to get gooey about it, or make those comments about how the tops of babies' heads smell.
Maybe there's another man, he blurts out.
Until he says it. He hasn't really considered this possibility. But what else can there be?
Sure, she took $2,000 out of their savings account the week before she left. A smart play on her part.
But how long can she go on $2,000? Someone has to be supporting her. She's not fit for much work beyond McDonald's. He writes a check for the retainer, and Ms. Sneed promises to be in touch within the week. He knows he should go to work, but he calls in with a family emergency and goes to Wagner's Tavern, the bar where he met Pauline.
A beer at lunch isn't really drinking. Not in a place like Wagner's. A cop bar tucked into a corner of Joppa Road. That was the first thing Pauline ever said to him. You a cop?
Do I look like a cop?
His hair was on the long side. His jeans tight. That's not a no. You could be undercover. You've got that look.
What kind of look is that?
Like a guy who's trying not to look like a cop. 45 minutes later, they were having sex in his car. It was weeks before she believed he wasn't a cop. Just a guy from a title company less than a mile up the street. Today at Wagner's, one beer turns into two, turns into three, and then he has to drink a big cup of coffee before he gets behind the wheel. Pauline'd kill him if he drove tipsy with Janny in the car. Well, too bad. You want to set the rules, you can get your goddamn ass home. And then, I'm gonna leave. Maybe she thought she was clever. That if she left first, he would change his mind about leaving. How had she even figured out what he was planning to do? A witch. That one. She's a witch. Sometimes, he used to wake up in the middle of the night and find her looking at him. The light from the street lamp threw a stripe across her eyes, and it was as if she were wearing a mask that allowed her to read his every thought. He turns on the radio. And it's that goddamn song that's on the radio all the time this summer, the one about chasing waterfalls. No one chases a waterfall. You go for a swim, and next thing you know, the current catches you and throws you right over. Chapter 8. A new convenience store, a Royal Farms, has opened near the spot where the bypass will eventually join the beach highway. It's a big deal in Belleville, and Polly has heard people in the bar talking about it. The old-timers claim they will never patronize the convenience store, the first to open in Belleville, where one family has long had a lock on the grocery trade. They see it as a symbol of everything that is wrong with Belleville and the world beyond. Open for 24 hours, undercutting the local gas station with its prices, a place where teenagers can be idle. As a local, at least for the time being, Polly should stay away. But there's something about the store's bright, shiny newness that promises anonymity, a rare commodity in this town. In the mornings, she finds herself walking more than a mile there to buy a Diet Mountain Dew or a Good Humor bar, the one with toasted almonds. It's a strange breakfast, to be sure, and she has to be careful about sweets. She wasn't always thin like this, and it was hard getting the weight off after Janny. But there's something about having an ice cream bar for breakfast that makes her feel truly free, maybe for the first time in her life. How thoughtlessly she squandered her freedom, taking up with Greg and getting pregnant. If anyone knew her whole story, that might be the truly shocking part, the way she ruined her own second chance. But no one knows her whole story. She plans to keep it that way. She eats the ice cream bar in the store's little alcove of preformed tables and benches, where almost no one else ever lingers. Only 9 a.m., it's already hot enough that the ice cream will melt quickly if she takes it outside, and she wants to eat it as slowly as possible. She catches a glimpse of a familiar face from the bar, one of the locals who claimed he would never come here. He's drinking a cup of coffee and eating some kind of breakfast sandwich made with a croissant. He registers her gaze, shrugs. Hard to know if the gesture is a sheepish concession to his hypocrisy, or a kind of hello. The kind that says, I see you, I like you, but I want to be alone. She thinks it's the first, but decides to believe it's the second. What does it matter? The same non-response is fine for either one.
A young woman comes in with two fretful children, boys, no more than 18 months apart, maybe both still in diapers, although the bigger one is walking alongside the double stroller. "Can I have?" he keeps whining. "Can I have?" Polly studies the children intently, waiting to see if she feels anything. No, she feels nothing. She is not an indiscriminate lover of children. Wait, that's not quite right. She feels intense empathy for the mother, who looks miserable. The poor thing has large, fleshy thighs, dotted with a scarlet rash. Her hair is almost half and half, 6 inches of dull brown roots, 6 inches of a brassy blonde that looks slightly greenish. She can't be more than 22 or 23, but she moves with the shuffling tread of a much older woman. She picks up milk, a carton of eggs, and with a quick look over her shoulder, a bag of off-brand chips, then pays with a card. Probably a welfare card, loaded with her food stamp benefits. That's the reason for the nervous look. She thinks someone is going to bust her for buying chips. Allowed, under the rules, but taxpayers always think they have the right to look over a welfare recipient's shoulder, dictate her choices. All the while, the older boy is whining, "Can I have? Can I have? Can I have?" It's like a high-pitched saw at a construction site.
"I want treat, too,"
the younger boy says. "I'll share my chips." The older child,
"I don't like those chips. Too spicy."
Polly can almost feel the woman's palm itch with a desire to slap him. Polly was on welfare once, very briefly, and very fraudulently, as she claimed a child she didn't have. It was a risk doing that, but she was stuck. She needed money to start a new life, so she borrowed a few things from another life, a name, a birth certificate, a daughter. Daughter. She should get another card to Janny, but it's tricky finding someone to mail it, someone westward bound, with a soft heart and no curiosity about the woman who doesn't want a Belleville postmark on her letters. Her fake daughter and real name had been enough to get temporary benefits from an emergency fund at the county level. She learned about food pantries, even took the bus to the occasional soup kitchen. Every dollar she could get her hands on, she had to use to put some kind of roof over her head, a room in someone else's row house, strictly cash. She had the good sense to settle in Baltimore County, although at the North End, and shopped around until she found a male social worker. He got her into a motel that was taking homeless families. Never asked to see the daughter she claimed to have, not even the one night he came to check on her, and brought a bottle of White Zinfandel. Then she went to legal aid, where she told the truth straight up, and that was good enough to get her the name change she needed. She kept it simple, going from Pauline Dittmars to Pauline Smith, and then Pauline Smith became Pauline Hansen when she married Greg. But she had been Polly as a kid, so it's no stretch answering to that again. She had thought about changing her name to Pollyanna, thought about using it again when Adam Bosk first asked her name. A little in-joke because she's pretty much the opposite of Pollyanna at this point. But a Pollyanna calls attention to herself, whereas a Pauline doesn't. The point of becoming Pauline Smith 4 years ago was to disappear and start over. So why was she in that bar, Wagner's, the night she met Greg? It was within walking distance of the motel. No more than a mile or two. Although that strip of Joppa Road wasn't very friendly to pedestrians. Dark, with cracked sidewalks leading past stores with dusty windows, places that sell things like blinds and suitcases and tile. She wasn't officially Pauline Smith yet, but she was on her way, trying the name out in anticipation of the day the paperwork came through. Still, it was dangerous to go to that bar. She could have been spotted by someone who knew her well enough not to be fooled by the red hair, long as it was by then. She couldn't have long hair when she was married to Dittmars. Too much like a leash, too easy to grab. Greg was very ordinary trouble, at least. Fun, at first. She didn't expect to see him again after that first night. And maybe she wouldn't have. If she hadn't gone back to Wagner's 2 nights later. Of course, she could never take him to the motel. She saw that right away. And she didn't have a phone. She told him that when he asked, and he laughed, thinking she was making a joke. "I don't," she said. "Give me your number, and I promise I'll call you." She made good on her promise 72 hours later, calling from a payphone outside the Bell Lock diner. When he asked her out for a real date, she told him that she worked at the mall, and he could pick her up in the food court. They went to a movie, had pizza. Then came the question she dreaded. "Can I take you home?" "Take me for a drive," she said. "Out into the country." 15 minutes later, she asked him to pull into the deserted parking lot outside a greenhouse, led him into a copse of trees. He actually believed that this was her thing, that she didn't want to make love in a bed, hardly ever. All summer long, they did it outdoors, and when fall came and her new identity was underway and she could get a for-real job, waitressing at a decent place, a crab imperial kind of place with fat tips, although the cab fare ate up too much of her earnings for the job to be practical, she started taking him into bathrooms and once the dressing room at Nordstrom. Sometimes they used his bed at his crummy apartment over on Loch Raven, but the pilled sheets, even when clean, felt itchy. She put a deposit down on a sweet little place over the city line near Belvedere Square. It was an old Victorian cut up into apartments, so the appliances were half-assed and the closets tiny. But she didn't mind. It was hers. The first place that had ever been hers. Still, she wouldn't have sex with Greg there. Force of habit, she guessed. Although maybe there was something deeper going on. Some part of her mind trying to tell her that her new life was here, and it was time to leave Greg behind. The last station on her journey to becoming Pauline Smith. Then she peed on a stick, and her life was over. Again. She had misread him badly. She believed him when he said he wanted their child. She told herself she had to stop thinking that every man was Ditmars, acted like Ditmars, thought like Ditmars. But maybe they were. She remembers when Greg spanked her the first time. She went numb, limp, terrified that she was going to do something crazy. But then it turned out that was all he wanted. Just a few light slaps, nothing more. She still wants to laugh when she remembers his face when she asked if he wanted a few whacks. That was something to behold. This gander wanted no sauce. But he had to take it, or be exposed for the bully he was.
"She's eating ice cream for breakfast!"
The older boy is pointing a finger in her face, almost touching the tip of her nose. It takes enormous control not to swat that finger away. "She's a grown-up." The boy continues to glare. Polly levels her eyes on him. He holds her stare for an impressive amount of time, but he finally folds. The woman struggles to get him into the 2-seater stroller with his brother, to roll out the door into the already burning hot day. She and Polly have the same number of hours ahead of them. But for Polly, who is on her day off, the hours feel like a long, slow bath in which she can luxuriate, whereas this young woman is confined, caught. Down in South Carolina, a woman is being tried for drowning her own kids, letting a car roll forward into a lake with them still strapped in the back. She claimed she was carjacked, but it turned out she just wanted to start over without the kids. A new man had entered the picture. A horrible thing to do. And yet, what would you have her do? Men leave their kids all the time, and no one thinks them unnatural for it. Not great guys, but not deviants. Women seldom have that option. Everyone likes to tell that story about the mom who is able to lift a car off her toddler. How maternal love can give you super strength. Polly's pretty sure it's bullshit. Besides, what if you're under the car with your kid? What do you do then? You can't save a kid if you can't save yourself. She grabs a penny saver, heads out into the long July day. Chapter 9. Adam is enjoying life more than he should. At least, that's the opinion of his boss. His real boss, not Mr. C, who is skeptical at the lack of results Adam has posted. But what can he do? It was never his intention to wind up here in Belleville, and he's keeping expenses to a minimum. His client actually has the nerve to suggest that Adam's earnings at the hi-ho should be counted against his per diem. Yeah, it doesn't work that way, he tells him. He cannot believe this guy wants to nickel and dime him all of a sudden. I don't know, the client says with a sigh. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe there's no money. Remember, 20% of nothing is nothing. Yeah, that's why I'm charging you expenses plus 40 hours a week, Adam thinks. And I could be charging you for my time 24/7, but I'm a good guy. You're only paying me for the time I'm actively with her. They are talking on his room phone. Adam has a mobile, but he tries not to use it and keeps it in his room at all times. A guy who takes a job working as a short order cook wouldn't have a phone like his. He did opt to use his real name, Adam Bosk, to keep things simple. If she got suspicious, she could go to the DMV, over the line in Maryland, and do a search. But why would she be suspicious? And how would she get there? Besides, all she would find is his address and his spotless driving record. Tell as few lies as possible. That's his rule. He knows he's lucky now that he wasn't able to strike up a friendship with Greg at the beach, per the original plan, because if he had started hanging out with her husband before she split, there's no way he could have shown up here, too, in Belleville. Why is she here? Does her husband know where she is? Does the husband know anything? Why did she leave him? And her little girl, how does that work? Feral, his client says of her. No capacity for genuine emotion. She's out for herself always. Whatever you do, his client says, don't turn your back on her. Then he chuckles in an odd way. Even face to face, you might not be safe with that one. Adam cannot reconcile these dire warnings with the woman he sees at work. No, she isn't warm, and she seems to have only two speeds with men, interested and uninterested. With him, she's flipped the switch so many times now he's almost dizzy. Not that he cares. He's strong. He's not going to muddy things. But that day at the auction, when he helped her to carry her new purchases into the apartment, even set up the bed for her, he had expected her to say something suggestive, throw him a signal. She couldn't get him out of there fast enough. And since then, she has been so cool. Nice, pleasant, but Max and Ernest get more attention from her than he does. That night, at work, the other waitress, Kath, catches him sneaking peeks at Polly through the pass-through for the food. Business has been picking up, and Mr. C now needs both women working Wednesday through Sunday. Kath, who has seniority, gets most of the tables. Polly has the bar and two tables near it.
You like her.
Kath's tone is almost accusing. What do you mean, I like her? I barely know her. Kath smiles.
I said, you're like her.
How so?
Mysterious. Not offering up much of anything? Not sure if you're staying or passing through?
Oh, I'm pretty sure I'm passing through.
What could entice you to stay?
She cocks a hip, gives him a look. She's cute, if you like that all-American type. He thinks about it, the pros and cons. If he takes up with Kath, he won't have to worry about making a mistake with Polly. And Polly strikes him as someone who would find a guy much more interesting if she definitely can't get to him. It could be messy, though, if Kath became attached. He has to be clear, say, this is just for fun, no strings. Not that there's a woman in the world who can hear those words if she doesn't want to hear them. It's out of my hands, he says. I got a job I have to get back to come fall. God, he hopes this job is over by fall, that he's secured his bonus, and is off on a trip. But I like to have fun. If you know anyone who's open to having fun, but not being serious. That night, Kath makes a big deal of parking her car behind the motel, waiting 15 minutes before she comes to room 3. It's a small town, she says. People will gossip soon enough. Once inside, she comes on pretty strong, almost too strong. He wouldn't have minded working a little harder. But she's good company, quick with a wisecrack while they watch baseball, then blessedly quiet when they go at it a second time, eager to make him happy. Still, when he studies her shoulders, her back in the moonlight, it's only a back, fleshy and earthbound. No wings. This is all I'm good for, he says to her back while he massages her shoulders. I'm not looking to date or have a girlfriend. You took Polly to that auction. She doesn't have a car.
I know. You ever wonder how she got here?
Without a car? He doesn't wonder because he knows. Bus?
Even if she did take the bus, why here?
Sign says it's one of the 10 best small towns in America.
Sure, if you're married with kids.
Or if you grew up here, I guess. She sips her beer, takes on a way too casual tone.
What's your excuse?
My truck was starting to overheat. I stopped rather than pushing it, risking the whole engine. Took a week to get the part, and by then I landed this job. I have the summer free, I can be where I want, and here seemed as good a place as any.
What kind of job do you have to go back to?
Sales. True enough. It's seasonal work. Also true. I'm an independent contractor. I don't get benefits, but I get lots of free time. All true. Adam makes top dollar. Always has more work than he needs.
What do you sell?
Depends on who hires me. She lets it drop. If a person is determined to be vague enough, almost no one has the forbearance, the curiosity, really, to keep asking questions. She doesn't ask about his parents, although Adam would be happy to talk about them. She doesn't ask about why he went to the CIA, much less why he dropped out. The instructors were assholes. No, Kath wants to talk about herself. Most people do. So, he asks her questions. Not too many, or she'll get too attached. Women can't help themselves when men ask them questions, so he listens, asks a little, but not too much. She has a younger sister, and he gets the sense that Kath feels she's a little bit in her shadow. The sister is married, just bought a house, and Kath still doesn't have a degree. Although she drops in and out of the nearby community college. She got into some trouble when she was in high school. Not a big deal, but it derailed her college plans, and somehow she never got back on track, but she's trying now. She has dreams. She's not going to be a waitress forever. She might not even stay in Belleville. When it gets so boring he wants to scream, he gives her a little kiss, and they go at it again. The next day at the Hi-Ho, she drops by during lunch hour, although she's not on the schedule. At the first opportunity, she reaches over and flicks an invisible something from his t-shirt. Make sure Polly sees. Oh, Polly sees. The rest of her shift, she switched back to interested, which amuses Adam to no end. He's pretty sure that she's going to ask him to come by and see her apartment. He's also sure that he's going to say yes to that, then no to whatever happens next. He enjoys the anticipation, plays the scene several ways in his mind. But the fantasy becomes impossible to keep in focus once a short, squat woman with a butch haircut comes in and orders a chef salad. He knows the second he sees her that she's a private investigator, and she's looking for the woman who's calling herself Polly Costello. Because like calls to like, and that's what he's doing here. Chapter 10. The chef's salad at the Hi-Ho is better than Sue expected. But then Sue's expectations aren't very high. Sue Sneed always keeps her expectations low. Yet somehow she still ends up disappointed. By chef salads, by people, professionally and personally. It's like there's a wall in her head, and nothing she learns about human nature from her job can get through to the other side. Sue, the person, is going to end up hiring Sue, the investigator, one day. Still, it's a really good salad. Crisp romaine, real bacon. It has been 3 weeks since Sue and Anna broke up. She saw it coming for a long time. But it was like a blizzard in the weather forecast, and she kept hoping she was wrong, that it wouldn't materialize, or that it would swing to the north or south. Baltimore has always had snowstorms like that. She remembered the last prophesied big one. The grocery stores and liquor stores and video stores denuded. Everybody preparing to hold up for days. Philadelphia got 13 inches. Baltimore woke up to pure sun and dry sidewalks. You might sidestep one blizzard, but another one will come for you. Anna was never going to be Sue's happily ever after. They had embraced the lesbian cliché, renting a U-Haul 6 weeks after they met to bring Anna's motley assortment of possessions to Sue's house. Anna brought new meaning to doesn't have a pot to piss in. Maybe that's why Sue had never expected her to stay, and maybe that's what doomed them, Sue's inability to believe that she could be enough for someone like Anna. A newly hatched baby dyke, fresh from a bad marriage. Anna wanted to romp for a while, and who could blame her? No, it was fair for Anna to leave her. Not so fair of her to raid the little safe where Sue kept some cash, or to take the Le Creuset Dutch oven that they had picked out together, but for which Sue had paid. It had been a nice winter, making stews and bolognese in that bright red dish. Then Anna had started complaining about her weight. "I'm getting fat, look at me." She would grab her non-existent belly with two hands while Sue contemplated her undeniable apple of a midriff. Wondered if Anna's distaste for her own body extended to Sue's. Anna then began carping about Sue's house. A neat, well-kept, but undeniably suburban house. A brick one-story that had the potential to be transformed into a mid-century marvel, but only if one spent twice as much as the house was worth. Baltimore's housing market was flat. Flat as Anna's belly. The house hadn't gained a dollar in value since Sue bought it 5 years ago, and it seemed crazy to Sue to take a second mortgage, harvesting what little equity she had managed to build. Anna brought home brochures for the condos going up along the waterfront, the promises of new developments where canning factories and shipyards had once stood. As if, Sue wanted to laugh. But Anna wasn't from Baltimore. She didn't know how often these dreams had been floated, how seldom they materialized. The Pauline Hansen case was a nice distraction from her thoughts about Anna, although she doubted it would end happily. "She can find almost anyone," she told the client. "But she can't make them do anything. It is not, alas, illegal to stop loving someone, as Sue knows all too well. Odd, sure, to walk away from your own daughter in the process. Maybe even creepy. But legal. Sue has been clear with Greg that she won't try to engage his ex if she finds her. She's not a go-between. She's a pointer. I find, you shoot. God, she hopes there's not shooting involved. But while the guy has a hothead vibe, he's never been arrested for anything violent, and there have been no police calls to the house on Kentucky Avenue. He probably hasn't told her everything, but that's okay. They never do. She hasn't told him everything, either. The ramifications of the name change that popped out of the Chicago title investigation. Maybe that's why Pauline Hansen ran. To put more distance between herself and her past. Again, it's legal to change one's name. Legal not to share everything with a new partner. This lady wanted a fresh start. And Sue won't deny her that. If only Greg Hansen knew that losing his wife could be the healthiest thing that could happen to him. Sue steals a look at the photo in her wallet, glances back at the woman behind the bar. Yeah, it was her. No doubt about it. She'd done nothing to disguise herself. Probably too vain to lose that amazing red hair. Still, it was a lucky break finding her so swiftly. She's been careful not to create a paper trail. No charges on the joint credit card, no withdrawals from the ATM. Finding her had been a bitch, but that just meant more hours, more money for Sue. She's gonna buy another Dutch oven. Only not red this time, maybe blue, or hunter green. Sue had started the week in Bethany, showing Pauline Hansen's photo around. If you work hard, you make your own luck, and lo and behold, Sue found a geezer who copped to giving the redhead a ride, saying he offered to take her all the way to D.C., but she surprised him by getting out of the car only an hour into the trip. No, he couldn't remember where. $100 later, he gave up the name, Belleville. He had dropped her off in Belleville. Once in Belleville, Sue made the tactical decision not to ask questions because it was way too small. Her queries would have gotten back to her quarry, could startle her into running again. So she walked around town, studying the shops, the restaurants. It's summer. Strangers aren't normal here, but they aren't completely unknown this time of year. There's a neighborhood of pretty Victorian houses and 19th-century stone homes. She pretended interest in those, all the while going in and out of various businesses. There's only a few places where a person's going to be able to work off the books. And this dump, the hi-ho, was so clearly one of them, and bingo, there she is. Better looking than her picture. Or maybe just sexier. Sue can tell that this one would sleep with a person if it advanced her agenda. Not a moral judgment on Sue's part, merely an assessment. Sex is currency to this woman. Sue knows the type. Sue dates the type, although she doesn't mean to. Sue doesn't try to talk to her. She doesn't want Pauline to remember her, even in hindsight. There's no real reason to do her job this way, except it amuses Sue to be invisible, to use her seeming deficits as assets. In a day or two, maybe a week, the husband will show up here, and this Pauline Hansen will search through her mind, try to remember the moment she was caught. She'll never find it. Sue Sneed. Sue Stealth, moving through the world without attracting attention. She knows what people think when they see her. Dyke, 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 dyke. They file her away under that heading and forget her. Great, makes her job easier. Refill? Pauline Hansen looms over her with an iced tea pitcher. Sure, Sue says. The woman has an almost literal scent on her. But it's not perfume. She smells like June itself. On its best day, warm and wild and promising. She reminds Sue of the tiny strawberries she used to find on that hill near her house, the ones she could never decide if they were safe to eat. Sue didn't grow up dreaming of being a private detective, but that was only because she didn't realize girls could be PIs. Sure, she read Nancy Drew and Trixie Belden, but did anyone notice that those girls never got paid? Sue wanted to be Mannix, or Barnaby Jones, or Paul Drake, the investigator that Perry Mason used. Instead, she started out as a middle school English teacher, but she was scared to have any kind of social life as long as she was teaching, even a secret one. She decided she had to find another gig. Around this time, her cousin, who had a small insurance agency, asked her to follow a guy claiming a back injury. Just that easy, Sue found her new vocation. She started in another PI's office, apprenticing, until she could get her own license. She loves her work. It is the perfect job for people who are curious enough, but not randomly, promiscuously curious. An incurious person, this target's husband, for example, could never do it. But a super curious person would also fail. You have to be willing to leave some doors closed, to focus on the task at hand. Some people are like rabbit holes, and you can fall a long, long way down if you go too far. Sue has asked herself repeatedly whether the husband is ill-intentioned. Sue doesn't want to deliver up a woman to a vengeful man. Had he hurt her? Is that why she ran? Would Pauline, who changed her name legally to Pauline Smith, then hid Pauline Smith inside Pauline Hansen, make that mistake again? Of course, to hear others tell it, she hadn't made that mistake the first time. That had been a lie she used as a cover. Still, Sue thinks she was telling the truth. Word on the street is that her first husband was dirty. Maybe even a killer. Ugh, gristle on the ham. But if she's fair, and Sue is always fair, the salad is outstanding in every other way. The proportions graceful, with lots of the things most places skimp on, turkey and bacon and chopped egg. And although a classic chef salad is served with the ingredients set in decorative rows along the top, someone has taken the time to chop it, the way they do at Marconi's, back in Baltimore, so each bite is perfectly dressed with a little bit of everything. Sue's favorite kind of salad. The cook keeps coming to the door and sneaking looks at her. Homophobe or xenophobe? Sue can't read him. But something is amiss. Is he jealous? Does he feel protective of Pauline? There's definitely a vibe there. Sue pays her tab and leaves, feeling her hackles rise. When she drives away, the cook is standing outside, pretending to smoke, studying her car. If he were to run the plate... But why would he run the plate? Her job is done. Almost too quickly. She thought she'd get a few more billable hours out of this one. If she were sleazy, she'd play both sides, ask Pauline Hansen how much it's worth to her not to be found, if her ex knows she used to be Pauline Dittmars and all that entails. But that would be wrong. And besides, Pauline Hansen clearly has no money. Sue shakes her head at her own foolishness, decides to go to a bar she knows, a discreet one, in Little Italy, where the locals pretend not to notice the women with good haircuts and well-tailored clothes. She needs to hold someone tonight. A dance or two would be enough, but maybe someone will want to come home with her. That would be nice. Once in the bar, vodka in hand, she finds herself looking for redheads, trying to find someone with that same sweet, wild strawberry scent of June. Chapter 11. Greg walks into the Hi-Ho 3 days after the visit from that salad-munching PI. Polly probably doesn't make the connection, but Adam does.
And you don't have to be a private detective to know that the man who slams the door open at 4:30 p.m., standing there backlit for a moment, all shadow in the afternoon sun, has a claim on Polly. Even Max and Ernest pick up on it. Yet, Polly couldn't be calmer. "What can I get for you?" she asks, drawing drafts for Max and Ernest.
"You can get your butt in the car and come home to your daughter."
"Our daughter. And I wager she's all I'm coming home to." "You've got one foot out the door, Greg. Can't blame me because I got both feet out before you did. Saves you the postage on the child support the way I see it.
Damn it, Pauline, I can't take care of a kid and work. She's your job."
"Yeah, well, I quit. Sorry I didn't give you 2 weeks' notice."
Unnatural, Adam's client had told him. He still doesn't believe it. She seems the opposite.